filled with a level of humility and really just task-oriented. It certainly wasn't about him. And then subsequently, I saw Barry over the course of time throughout my time at Citywide. I was serving here and served pretty consistently for 5 years in some capacity here at Citywide, and Barry has been a part of that journey throughout my time, and it's been really special. But also, I've seen him doing service at PPG and in other capacities in our community. He's very present, and that's probably why there's so many people here who can raise their hand and call him their friend. I think that Barry is a wonderful example of the principle of humility. Blind Dave at PPG one time, people were talking about the principles for all the steps, and he said, you know what the principle of step one is? Humility. You know what the principle of step two is? Humility. You know what the principle of step three is? Humility. And I think that Barry carries that because his presence, he shows up, he cares, and he does work for people. Recently, I had something. He asked me to go to a movie, couldn't go because I had to do something else. He offered to help me. And the thing about Barry is that he means it. He's not just saying it. So he's a dear friend of mine. I love you very much. And I think he's a wonderful man. Barry F.
Thank you. Woo! Scariest thing in the world, and a speaker comes up with a full moonshine jug. Hello, everyone. My name is Barry Flynn. I'm an alcoholic. I've been clean and sober since January the 10th of 1999, and for that, I'm very grateful. I picked up 25 years this last January. And and if you've ever done anything to carry this message, and if you ever sat in a meeting with me, I want to thank you for all 25 of those years. And anyway, stories begin at the beginning. I was born. I took it personal. I'm one of the rarest things anyone here is ever going to meet. I'm actually a native Austinite. Born here in Austin. My grandparents live in Tarrytown. I mean, it's, you know, it's the whole thing. And you know, y'all, a few years ago, I had a job at a little convenience store, and it was, we would sell a lot of steel reserve to the homeless and stuff as they came by. And there was this guy that came up one time, and he, he was stinking, he was smelling. It's not just that he lived on the streets, but you just look at him and you knew that he had been for years on the streets, you know. And he walks up to me and he takes out this little thing passing as his billfold. It all comes to pieces. He's trying to like buy steel reserve with nickels and pennies and stuff. And one of the things in his wallet is a picture of him years earlier in a United States Air Force officer's uniform. We were only about 2 or 3 feet apart, but man, it's a long way from here to there. And I guess when the end really comes for all of us, we're hitting bottom, we never know. It just comes up right then. And I don't know what it is that was wrong with me, but I know that whatever was wrong with me was wrong from the beginning. There was just this fear from the very minute day. I mean, like you will have this feeling of anxiety, this feeling of impending doom, this feeling that something's going to go wrong. I like had that the first day of kindergarten. I'm sitting there looking out around and man, you know, I look at all these kids. I'm like, my God, I can't go out there for recess. They're going to kill me. What the hell is going on here? And I just had this fear inside of me all the time. And it was above all a fear that people were watching me and that I was being judged. It was just this gnawing going on in me. You know, my parents were too gray peeled. The thing I need to tell you about my parents is this. For all the problems that we had, if you judge parents by did they give you a better life than they had, my parents get A+. On that criteria, they get A+. But they were both people from two terrible alcoholic households. And they brought that lifestyle into the home when I was when I was growing up. The thing is this, if you're a child and you're raised in a home that's full of anger, you adapt to that. And the main way that I adapted to it was becoming a liar. I was a liar from a real early age on. I was a liar because I was afraid that an argument could become physical at any moment. I was a liar because in a household like mine, if you bring up something that's uncomfortable and becomes an argument, it's your fault. I was a liar because if you have an argument with someone, it might permanently damage the relationship and the friendship somehow. From the very beginning, I wanted to be whoever was in front of me right now, whatever it is that they wanted me to be. I wanted to adapt and mold in. I wanted to be someone that could be loved. I just had that hunger and ache in me from the very beginning. And when I was very, very young, I had this horrifying fear of rejection. I would see other kids walk up and make friends and play football with each other, and I just did not know how it is that they did that. And it was just constantly seething away in me, this fear that I was somehow wrong and that y'all knew it. I mean, it was always this fear. Even when I was with my friends, it was like, man, my buds over here, if they find something cooler to do than me, they're going to take off like that. And that was just always there. And like, you wonder what it is that has to do with alcoholism. You know, I was so into fantasy and comic books, Star Wars, all this stuff like that. If you had been able to read minds, you walked up to me, one of the first things you would have thought to yourself is, man, this kid needs a drink. I did not have a problem with vodka in seventh grade, but my God, it would have helped out a lot. It really would have. I was, you know, this late bloomer, and I was a weird kid. I was a bedwetter. I didn't learn how to tie my shoes for a long time. I'm a special education teacher today. I have no idea. I mean, I'm certain a school psychologist would have a field day with me for an afternoon. But all these things were going on. And I can remember that the first time that I ever took a drink of alcohol was the best thing that ever happened to me in my life. It really was. I was this kid with these weird, dark, obsessional thoughts. And I went out with some guys one time, and you know, we're going out there. I don't know how to make jokes with people. I don't know how to talk to people. I've worn these glasses since second grade. I had that pizza zit face complexion. I had the social skills of a cabbage. And I went out there with some guys, and when we got to where we were going, their older brother showed up with some old English 800. And on the way out there, I didn't know how to be friends. I didn't know how to talk to people. We started popping the tops on those, and 30 minutes later, I was doing naked wind sprints in the lobby of the Holiday Inn. I'm not an Alcoholics Anonymous because the last drunk was so bad. I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous because the first drunk was so good. I owe a debt to alcohol. If I had never found alcohol, I would have tied a noose up in the garage at some point. Living with this inner critic, that perfectionist that knows everything that you've ever done stupid, I would not sentence my worst enemy to live with that guy. Alcohol saved me. And man, the first few years, they were just totally without consequences. I was a runner in high school. I had that metabolism, staying up all night drinking, going home, getting 20 minutes of sleep, and then going to work or going to school. That was nothing. I could do it like that. I was very long into my drinking career before I ever had a hangover. I mean, my institution, my metabolism back then was just really awesome. And I'm really just going to sort of cut through the chase right here. I mean, I don't have much of a drunkologue. The main thing to know about me is that the first time that I drank, it was really good, and it was just a little bit less good every time. I would sit there and I would start to feel consequences. See, I sit there and I tell you that my first few years were without consequences, but I was sitting at home one day and my dad comes up and he pulls out the psych report on my grandmother, who I had never met. She had been locked up in the Austin State Hospital. My grandfather was a dentist, and she was addicted to his morphine. And she was like, I mean, they're throwing around words in this report like sociopath, becomes violent when frustrated, charming but capable of exploding without any warning. I tell you that I had no consequences, but I honestly don't think that my dad would have read that to me and shown that to me if he didn't already see that there were some storm clouds on the horizon. And, you know, throughout my life, there would just be a steady stream of consequences. In the doctor's opinion, it states that frothy emotional appeal cannot stop the alcoholic. Another way of saying that is consequences. If you saw how it is that I drank, you would assume that I was someone who had no fear of jail whatsoever. I was terrified of jail. If you saw how I drank, you would assume that I had no financial worries. No, my parents worked 60 hours a week and we didn't have a nickel to show for it at the end of the week. I have always battled against financial insecurity. But nothing overcame my need for alcohol. Nothing was able to match it. I'm not an alcoholic because I drink too much. I'm an alcoholic because I can never, ever drink enough. And, you know, that bottomless pit, that cruel emptiness inside of me, it was showing up more and more often. I was once arrested. I mean, they called it aggravated assault. I don't know. But like, you know, the first time I was arrested, I didn't drink for a month. The second time I was arrested, I didn't drink for a week. And the third time I drank the day that I got out. There's this line on page 109 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous in the middle of Two Wives. And it says, he wants to quit. And there were some scary things coming up. At the end, I don't remember how I got home once in the last 2 years. It was blacked out straight up. I got out of college. I graduated with a, I was this young intellectual. So I graduated with a degree in history and a minor in creative writing. And I came back and the only thing that I could find was a job as a teacher. And I bought a brand new car. I really thought that my life was going to start turning around. And I went to the Dog and Duck pub one day. And me and the rest of the guys, we were teaching at the Alternative Learning Center in East Austin. And we started knocking them back. And a few of the guys also had some nice, pretty little pills. And I got into a blackout and I smashed my car into a Suburban parked in front of Z Tejas on the way home. For those of y'all who are unfamiliar with the geography of Austin, Texas, Z Tejas is directly across from the Austin ISD Administration Building. Man, I got home, woke up the next day. Pray to God that was a nightmare. I go out there, the hood of the car is up like this. I have no idea how I saw well enough to even get home. And, you know, I called them up, insurance took care of it, and I actually got a strange lesson that day. The lesson that I took from that day was this. If you're destroying yourself, but insurance is paying for it and cleaning it up, a lot of society will sit back and just watch you destroy yourself. I'm not sure what it is, but no one in my work, in my family, had ever spoken to me about the fact that my drinking was out of control. You know, I had so many good luck, so much good luck coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was teaching at the Alternative Learning Center, one of the teachers there was sober. And he gave me something. You know, he was this old guy. He would tell the worst jokes in the world. He chased every skirt that came within 2 miles of him. But he did something very important for me. He was an example of someone who identified as an alcoholic, was not drinking right now, and seemed to be happy. That came up for me. When I finally, finally one night when I was going home and God, we used to play the sneak game. We go down to the bars, we get blackout drunk, and then we drive back. And the only thing that woke us up and kept me from killing us was that My tires would hit the reflectors in the middle of the road. We called it driving in Braille. And there, the only thing that saved me that night, basically one night, Williamson County decided I needed to make my amends spontaneously. And, you know, I can remember so much wanting to actually quit at that time. On one hand, when the probation officer told me that I could not drink during the terms of probation, in the back of my head, I remember thinking, I would rather die than not drink. On the other hand, I can also remember this feeling of, I am out of control. I am terrified of this, and I know for a fact I'm stopping at the liquor store on the way home from the probation office. And that gnawing fear is coming up on me. On page 24 of the big book, it says that the alcoholic cannot recall with sufficient force of memory the pain, suffering, and humiliation of a month, a week, or even a day ago. We are without mental defense against the next drink. And, you know, I had already been going through this process. I would wake up every day and, man, I would have these terrible hangovers, nauseous, ribs sore from throwing up and dry heaving, terrible pounding hangovers. And I would wake up and I'd be pressing my face into the cool tile on the bathroom floor, trying to get some relief. And I'd think to myself, oh God, what excuse can I use for work? And I'd look around on the floor of my apartment and I'd try to locate the clothes that looked the cleanest. You know, and every day as I did that, I would yell out the alcoholic national anthem, I'm never gonna do it again. And at that moment, I absolutely meant it. If you had me hooked up to a lie detector, if you injected me with true serum, sodium pentothal, I would have passed any test that you had going for me. But I just did not have that force of will anymore. I walked into, I walked around, and the last 6 months of my drinking, the universe really got quiet with me. It really did. I was struggling to try and control it at that time. I ended up going out in Christmas of 1998 to meet my Uncle Bob. Bob, who took me to my very first AA meeting. I went out there, and my Bob and my dad still claimed that they did not know that I was an alcoholic. Unfortunate, the rest of Texas did seem to know, but that's another issue. And I went there, and Bob went, took us. It's the coolest part of my story. My very first AA meeting actually was in a church basement. I went with Bob to a noon meeting, and I sat there and I listened to those people. And then Christmas Eve, 1998, Bob is the keynote speaker at an Alcathon, one of the 24-hour meetings that they have in California. And I go out there and I listen to Bob share his story. And then they take their smoke break and then they come back and they open up. And these people stand up and start talking about alcoholism. One lady sits there, and I'm never going to forget this lady. Never. She stands up and she says, I used to walk through a not safe neighborhood in Oakland, California. Because if I took a cab to the bar, that was one drink I was giving up on the way there. And if I took a cab home, that was another drink that I was giving up. And before I heard her, I had no idea that other people counted their booze like this. This is a rent check, or it's a full weekend with some other stuff. This is a meal, but if I give up a meal, that's an entire 12-pack. I had no idea that other people counted it like that. And I listened to those people, I'm identifying with them, I'm identifying with Bob, and I think to myself, well, I'm gonna come back here if it gets bad. And that was 2 weeks later. You know, there was a janitor who was leaving us. He was gonna go live with his family up in New York. I was teaching at this little middle school here in West Austin, and I was sitting there with the guy, rest of the guys at the tavern at 12th and Lamar. And everyone else was getting tore up. And I was sitting there breaking my arm, patting myself on the back, and just having some Diet Coke. And at the end of the night, a student teacher pays for his girlfriend's drink and for his drink, and then they both just take off. I have been sitting there promising myself not to drink. And the waitress looks at me and says, "These are already paid for. Do you want them?" And I just inhaled both of them. And it's called a temporary moment of clarity. After I drank those two drinks, I heard a voice in my head, and I can hear it as clearly as you can hear my voice right now. And that voice said, "Your life is about to get much worse." And I wasn't exactly winning gold medals at that moment. I have been doing my community service for the courts at the Williamson County Literacy Center, which at that time was exactly two blocks away from the Hope Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The next night I was up there doing the GED classes. At 8 o'clock, a lot of the probationaries went down there to get their cards signed. And I went ahead and clocked out and went with them. And when I walked down there, I was not happy to be there as I walked in Alcoholics Anonymous. For so many years, drinking had been the only thing that was able to relax me. The first time that I ever drank, I put my hands up on my head and I thought to myself, "I wonder if this is what normal feels like." Because for once, that inner critic had shut up and gone away. The fact that alcohol could no longer do that for me was the saddest thing in my life. The fact that it, of all things, had turned on me. I walked in there, I sit down, and I did the most dangerous thing an alcoholic can do. I listened. I don't know what it was that I expected to be in that AA meeting, but what I heard was a lot of people talking about, "I cannot stop drinking, even though no one hates my drinking more than I hate my drinking." The subject of the meeting was terminal uniqueness, that feeling that this only happens to you. Life gangs up on you. Life is always unfair. I listened to these people. I walked in there looking down on them, thinking to myself, "I'm clearly better than any of these people." And by the end of that meeting, I felt much closer to them than I felt to my own family. At the end of the meeting, a guy stands up and he holds up a small silver piece of plastic and he says, "This is our desire chip for anyone who wants to try this way of life." And I stood up and I got one. And I sat down. And there was a little old lady behind me and she leaned forward and she whispered into my ear, "I hope you know that everybody in this meeting is secretly rooting for you to make it." And that was my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've not had a drink since that day. And everything's been fine. No, I came in on this great pink cloud. My third night in, like my third AA meeting, we had a meeting on the four step. I talked for about as long as I've talked here tonight. It was just a lot. I got so much out of the fact that walking into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous lifted so much of my feelings of despair. There was, to me, a lot of shame fell away when I realized that I wasn't the only person, that it's not okay. I'm not stupid. I'm not retarded. I'm not crazy like my grandmother. There's a name for this, you know. I did that, and I was doing that for a while. I went to a lot of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and I did a lot of service work, and I did not do the steps yet. And one night when I was about 9 months sober, I got a call from my mom. She wanted me to come over. My parents had divorced when I was 21, very mysterious. No one had ever talked about or anything. And I walked over to my mom's place, and my sisters are already there. And I asked him, "What's going on?" And what my mom wanted to tell me was about, hello? Anyway, what my mom wanted to tell me was that there was actually a history of sexual abuse in our family. And I didn't know about it. And as an alcoholic, there are two times that you want to drink. The first time you want to drink is, oh, it might feel good again. The second time is when you're thinking to yourself, I don't give a damn. I did not think that alcohol would make me feel good again at that point. But I wanted the entire world to pause and let me off. Because without it, I didn't know what to do. At that time in my life, I was going through this stage. If someone said something really cool in a meeting, I would walk up to them in front of everyone and ask them to be my sponsor. I would take their name and I would, very important, never call them again. Because I had the public approval and that was all that was required in this situation. Y'all, hey, how you doing? Thank you. Y'all, hey. Y'all, a hand for Riverbend Church, which stood by us during the COVID lockdown. And when my mom told me that, I reached into my pocket. I had one of those numbers. I called this guy up. His name was Gary. He was a combat veteran from the Navy. And I called him up and I told him what happened. He said, I want you to go to Eckerd's drugstore. I want you to get a Big Chief writing tablet. And I want you to make out two lists. I want you to make out a list of anyone who has ever pissed you off. And I wanted you to make another list of anyone that you would not want to see if you were walking down the streets right now. I did not realize this. Gary had started me on my fourth and fifth step. And I took my time with that. When I got my 1 year chip, Gary told the room that I worked the 12 steps like a turtle galloping through oatmeal. But I did finally get through that. I mean, when I met with him to go over that, if in seventh grade I was walking down the street and I said hello to you and you didn't say hi back, your name was on there. And when I got together with Gary, because like Gary was really honest with me about this stuff. He was really super honest with me. I would sit there and I'd talk about some of my resentments and he'd be like, dude, do you actually resent this guy or does he just sound smarter and funnier than you do in the meetings? Do you really resent this girl or did you ask her out and she said no? And like, I was seeing it at this Mexican food restaurant. I'm like, man, I eat all these chips. By the time the entree gets here, I'm going to be full. I'm just da 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 da. He reaches over and he puts his hand on top of my hand and looks at me. Barry, you need to worry about your addictions in the order that they're killing you. There was this great basketball coach, John Calipari. And one night, Louisville and Kentucky, KU, two big, big rivalries. They're sitting there and Calipari is yelling at this kid. He is sitting there screaming at him. Kid, I love you, but if you can't rebound, I have to pull you out of the game. And that was Gary for me. Kid, I love you, but if you can't be honest, this program is not going to work for you at all. And he told me that. And I sat down and I start going over all of these resentments and all of these fears. The most powerful spiritual experience of my life was that very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. That fifth step was a very close second. When I was going through those resentments and fears, I literally felt things lifting off of me. There was a physical feeling of freedom starting to come about. At the end of it, Gary goes out and he takes his final smoke break, his Cool Filter Kings. He comes back in, he looks at me and says, is there anything else? And like everyone else in here, there are three things that are from the sex inventory. I was never going to share them with anyone. And I had not written them down. Instead, I looked at him and I just thought for a moment, this has worked so far. And I went ahead and I told Gary those three things. We went down on our knees and we did the 6- and 7-step prayer. The first line of that prayer is, God, I'm willing that you should have all of me, the good and the bad. When we stood up, Gary looked at me and he said, Barry, I want you to know that I love you. Because for the first time, I feel that I really know you. And to this day, I try to say that to guys when we're doing the big inventories, because I want them to know that. When Gary said that to me, no one had said anything like, I love you to me in a long, long time. And I was sitting here, we need to see how much time, because leaving me without a timer is really dangerous. It's, yeah, you just took your life, you know. Anyway, you know, he's like, you're going to have to make amends to your dad. And I was like, Barry, your parents had you late in life. They're probably going to pass away sooner than you're expecting. When they pass away, two things are going to happen. First off, you're going to suddenly remember the good times, the times that y'all were a great family. And by the way, we were. There were a lot of good times in our family. And the second thing is this, you're going to suddenly realize that you don't have anyone to blame for your life anymore. So you're going to make amends to your parents, or when they pass away, they're going to take you with them. That's how this works. And I walked up to my dad and I went ahead and I made amends to him. I made amends for all it. And for the first time, I did something in which at the end, I didn't turn around and say, oh, but I did it because of this and it's this fault. I didn't do that for once. My dad didn't know how to take it. He sort of walked away from me. A few nights later, we're driving around. We're the only two up. It's like 1, 2 a.m. in the morning. My dad looks at me and says, you know, the night that you were arrested for aggravated assault, me and your mom had not spoken with each other for months. We came over and we sat at the kitchen table and we talked about you and about these problems, this anger that you've had your entire life. And I want you to know something. Me and your mom, we both know that you didn't exactly get the best hand of cards in life when you were growing up. That was the best amends that my dad was able to make to me, and I love him for it. That was all that I needed. And, you know, throughout Alcoholics Anonymous and my time here, it's always been about that. You know, I've had some things happen in my life. There are moments in which I've just not been able to be on the beam and I've not been spiritually connected. A few years ago, it happened like that. My older sister, who I dearly love, she passed away from cancer. They told us she had 6 months. 6 weeks later, she was gone. 2 years after that, her daughter, my beloved niece, was killed in a drunk driving accident. I was sitting there and I was so enraged about this and so mad at this guy. And I was like, man, why is it that this happens to my family? And, you know, the guy at his sentencing, and to be honest with you, he was a person who did not speak English as a first language. So it's possible that the translator messed up. But when he was asked to make a statement, he said, if she was meant to be alive, she would be. I walked out of that courtroom. And I needed a sponsor. I'd fallen out of touch with Gary, hadn't called him in so long. I found another sponsor and we got together and we did the writing in the book. Page 64 of our basic text says that resentment is the number one offender. From it stem all form of spiritual illness. It kills more alcoholics than anything else. I started going to the primary purpose group, Tuesday nights, South Lamar, and Charlie Parker was up there and he read that one time and he stops and he looks at the room. He says, if this is true, if resentment kills more alcoholics than anything else, does that mean that resentment kills more alcoholics than alcohol kills? As I was looking back over my life and I was dealing with these things, I started to look at the situation. when that man had driven through the red light and slammed into Shauna's truck and killed her. They were at an intersection that was actually not that far from the house I grew up in. In other words, an intersection that I had flown through blind drunk about a million times. When he said that, he didn't say he hit her on purpose, he said he reached over to change the radio, something I probably did about 20 times on my way up here tonight. And you know what? That courthouse that he said that in, that was the same courthouse that I was sentenced for my DWI. In Alcoholics Anonymous, I was taught that under resentment, you write out the four columns, and then you write the sick man's prayer on page 67. You put their name in it. Perhaps Barry is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God save me from being angry. Thy will, not mine, be done. And I slowly started to come back. I had been asleep for so long. I had done that great fourth and fifth step, and after that I had just coasted. But now I was really being brought back. I was brought back. I called up my friends, Ricky Clack and Drew Gearlove, and they said, man, Drew said, you need to start coming to the Bridge to Shore men's meeting. You need to start coming there with us. Ricky told me you need to start going to Primary Purpose Group. I was going up and I was starting to restart my life in some way. And I was starting to try and see that, you know what, I had to keep going. Page 164 of the book says that more will be revealed. You know, more will be revealed. You know what? More will be required. And I had to do that at this point in my life. And I had to be humble. I had to meet friends like John. I had to come in here and start doing service work. I went to an AA conference, and the happy people there, they all talked about how they had service commitments. I take a meeting to this jail. I take a meeting to this treatment center. I'm the secretary at my home group. I came here to the next meeting of the citywide group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, I want to be a volunteer, and I was made a volunteer coordinator. And since 2017, I have not gone one day without having a commitment at this group. I have been so happy and so overwhelmed with joy. To be the trusted servant of this group. My friends here in the citywide community, you all have saved me so many times. It has been an honor to be trusted by you with this occupation. And in my group, the thing that I found is this: when I do that work, it makes me better in other parts of my life. I'm a special education teacher. I had one student, he was on the autism spectrum, and he had an explosive anger disorder. His entire arm is a sleeve of scar tissue because he bites himself whenever he's angry. This kid comes into my room. All the principals are like, oh, these parents, they always sue and stuff. That kid comes into my room for a year. At the end of the year, we're having this big ARD meeting, A-R-D, and all this stuff is going on. The parents in the district do not like each other. The dad looks over and points to me, and because they're talking about changing placement for this child. The dad points to me and says, no, putting my son in Mr. Flynn's room is the only thing good that y'all have done for my son. That's how it is that Alcoholics Anonymous was able to assist me. Another student that I had, she came in, she had a seizure disorder. And by seizure, I mean 20 or 30 seizures a day. And they had a VNS input into her. And the only problem was this. You know what a VNS is? It actually goes into the nervous system. There was a child in California who had the same order, had the same procedure, and afterwards had shown signs of psychosis. But when you're a parent, you don't get to make easy, painless decisions. When she had seizures, she sometimes stopped breathing. The VNS had to go in. About a week after it comes in, she's walking around the classroom. Everything's going good. Suddenly, she stands up and just frisbees plates across the room at our head. We're going down to the gym one day. She reaches out with a hand and rakes her fingernails across the face of the assistant principal.
she would let out these blood-curdling screams, and she couldn't tell us what she was hallucinating, but it was intense. And man, I remember that it was just one day, it was a bad day. It was a bad day. It's just, it's a tough, demanding job. And she's getting help to use the restroom. And she looks at this little old lady, this teacher's aide, and the teacher's aide says, "Michelle," not her real name, "I hope you know that we really love you." And this little girl starts crying. When they came out and told me that story, I learned a lesson in Alcoholics Anonymous that's even more important to me today than don't take a drink one day at a time. I learned that it's not about me. If I go into a situation, the only thing I'm thinking about is myself, it's not going to turn out well. If I'm not giving an order to God, if I'm not seeing how I can be of maximum service to my fellows, if I'm sitting there and I'm just focused on how I look in the situation, then that's how it is that that's not going to work out. And, you know, my friend Tanya was here, and Tanya from PBG, and she set me up with this service commitment. I started taking a meeting out to Central Texas Treatment Center. And my friends Josh and George, they're up here right now. They're two great guys I met, and met out there. And, you know, I was going out there. I'm thinking, man, I'm going to take a meeting to a treatment center. I'm going to walk out there. I can't wait to show them all that I know. I walk into there, and there's a meeting that starts off. It's not going that great. And one of the guys stands up and says, "Guys, I want us to talk about amends. All of us in here," and it's an all-male group, "all of us wish that we were not incarcerated. We wish that we were out there being husbands and fathers to our families. It is incredibly humiliating for all of us to be in here." And the meeting that happened after he said those words was amazing. And it reminded me why it is I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. Some days you can be witness to really incredible things. And I'm going to go ahead and leave us with, there are just two things I'm going to leave us with here. First thing is, my favorite quote in the big book is on page 124. "In God's hands, a dark past is our greatest possession. With it, we hold the key to alleviating the misery and the suffering of others." I found in Alcoholics Anonymous that you go through a lot of things. But my Bolden family, my PPG family, my citywide family, in Alcoholics Anonymous, you never have to go through anything alone ever again. And the last thing I want to say is this. I don't know all of you and everything that you're going through, but I sure hope you know that everybody in this meeting is secretly rooting for you to make it. I love you, and thank you very much for letting me be of service to you.